got to think of it this way. It's quite an experience to be second in Peru Bay by centimeter.
Welcome to the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. I'm Matthew Piaro, editor of the magazine and host of the pod. Do you remember what race was supposed to run this Sunday? It was supposed to be Paris-Roubaix. But more important, do you remember who won Paris-Roubaix on April 8, 1990? Well, when Belgian Eddie Plankert and Canadian Steve Bauer crossed the line on the Roubaix Velodrome 30 years ago, neither of them was sure. After a lot of deliberation by race officials, the win went to Plankert. After 265.5 kilometers of hard racing, Plankert beat Bauer by millimeters. In March, I spoke with Bauer. The CCC Pro Team sports director had recently returned home to St. Catharines, Ontario from Europe and was in self-isolation. We discussed the monument that almost went to a Canadian. Steve Bauer, while you were a professional racer, what did Paris-Roubaix mean to you?
Well, I think as I turned professional and you know moved into Europe, it was one of the it was one of the big deals, one of the one races that I thought I could do well at. And made it part of my goals, you know, to do my best. And so, yeah, it became a focus. I wouldn't say an obsession, but yeah, okay. That's being professional is understanding the race in and out. And, you know, that's what I did. I became a study of it as I should.
Tell me more about your preparation and reconnaissance, especially for the 1990 edition of Paris-Roubaix.
Well, I don't think 90 was too much different than any other year. Usually you would pick a day or two to review the course and ride it and, you know, refamiliarize yourself with, the pavé sectors and how you get into them is all important. And, you know, whether you're turning left into them, right into them, or straight on, or when they're coming up, those, you know, repetitions just make it all the better understanding of how the race evolves. But yeah, usually you would do a solid ride either the Wednesday or the Thursday before the race. I think often it was Thursday, then you have Friday, Saturday recuperations and Sunday race.
Were there any particular sectors that year that concerned you more than others?
Well, you always had to be not any particular one would stand out, but each one could be decisive. So you had to be on your toes at all times. I mean, the forest of Arenberg is always like a turning point, usually because it's a fairly large peloton that enters there, and it's about 100 km to go. And you come out, and depending on the wind, the race is broken up, or it's diminished, and the race sort of starts from there. So it's a really important point, whether or not it kind of goes from there or not. It's different, but that's a turning point. And then as you knock off each sector along the way, you always have to be alert to, certain conditions, whether it's wet or muddy or the wind direction is always important.
Were there any special modifications that you made to the Eddie Merckx bike that you took to that race?
I think there's only year one that I put extra handlebar tape on. Other than that, I never, adjusted the handlebars at all. Sometimes you would lower your saddle just a little bit, your seat height, just to give you a little bit more, just a little more room, to be comfortable on the cobble so you weren't bouncing on the saddle as much. You'd be a little bit more fluid. So, those are a few things. You could raise your stem just a bit, to be a little more upright, a little more comfort. That's about it. you know. Oh, the tires, yeah. You needed bigger tires. At the time, I think we were using Vittoria greens, not a green tread, and they were 28 millimeter, I think.
During the 1990 Paris-Roubaix, Eddie Plankert of Team Panasonic got away in a move with about 100 kilometers to go. You would face him later in the Roubaix Velodrome, but at that point, you were still back in the bunch. What gave you the confidence to stay there, or had the race decided your position at that point?
You know, I think most big races are often about, being patient and not sort of, exposing yourself to the wind and following the evolution of the race methodically rather than going out too early and attacking. I mean, Plankert had an amazing ride to be out front in the wind all that time and still to win the race. To have the energy still at the end to, follow my attacks in the final, et cetera. So, he was in, pretty amazing form to be able to do that. So, as I think if I recall, following the evolution of the race, as the peloton gradually disintegrates and gets smaller, and then the attacks start opening up as riders try to bridge across to that lead group, which was still out in front. Then it became a matter of timing, having good legs and timing the right attack to make the final move.
With Plankert away, and he was with various riders for a while, mostly Marcel Gaillon and Kurt van Kiersbroeck. Edwig van Hooijdonk then went clear to join that group. And Panasonic seemed to be trying to manage the bunch for Plankert. Laurent Fignon seemed to be doing a lot of work. It just seemed messy behind. How were you managing that situation?
I think I was less aggressive than I typically would be, and that probably helped me a lot, just to have that patience and let everybody get tired, attacking. And Fignon was extremely strong. He was very, very strong. But he was also, I think he's generally marked by the Panasonic guy. So they used up some of their gas to, keep him in check, and maybe other riders did too. And if I remember, I think it wasn't too long after Fignon made a fairly, very vicious attack that sort of, hurt everybody. And then I went after that, shortly after, to bridge across, if my memory is correct. So, Fignon was actually important for my outcome, for him to be strong and actually doing a lot of the work sometimes that I would have done in other races. But he was instrumental in keeping that breakaway close, by his constant attacking and trying to get away and trying to bridge.
When you did join the lead group, it became a group of six, including you. Then, I think it was on Carrefour de l'Arbre, you pushed a little hard and you shattered that group. It was about 20 kilometers to go. Only Van Hooijdonk and Plankert were able to keep up with you. Was it a conscious decision to try and split that group and get rid of people?
Yeah, I mean, when I bridged across the front group, I was feeling quite good. And I was actually quite surprised how quickly I got to them. And then, I think there was an interlude where we rode a bit together, and then the Carrefour de l'Arbre is typically a classic attack point because of its twisty turns and rough and cratered cobbles on each side of the track there. So it's the first part of Carrefour de l'Arbre and all the way through is very difficult. So I did a full on attack to try to go for it. I think Eddie was just sort of like pinned on my wheel, like trying to hold on for a while. And unfortunately I couldn't get rid of him. And Van Hooijdonk was the only guy that came back at that point. And from that point on, Eddie, he didn't do a lot of work. He was saving himself for a sprint. I tried a couple times to get rid of him, but couldn't. And I think that's why, the two other riders who would catch us in the Velodrome, Wampers and Gaillon, and make it five for the sprint.
Before you got to the velodrome, how was it working with two Belgians? Were you worried about a Belgian combine to work against you?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't too worried about Edwig van Hooydonk. I mean, he seemed tired. Like, he seemed a bit tired. Like, I think I tried a couple attacks, and he struggled to come back to us. And the only reason why he came back to us each time was that he wasn't working with me. Or he wasn't working that hard, you know. So Eddie was definitely saving himself for the sprint, and I was just trying to keep us away or try to get away from them too, but I wasn't able to drop either of them.
So as you mentioned in the finale, the three of you come into the velodrome, and then you're joined pretty quickly by Marcel Gaillon and Jean-Marie Wampers, who won the year before. He won Paris-Roubaix the year before. What were your thoughts when suddenly three became five?
You know, it was a bit of a surprise, but I wasn't too concerned. I if you watch the video, I immediately went up the banking. You know, the track experience was handy. I went up the banking so I could see everything and not necessarily take the lead. So then those other two guys, when they came through, they went right to the front, which didn't really pose any problem. I think Wampers, you know, tried to lead out Eddie. So I was, you know, really is mostly concerned about Plankard, you know, cause he was, you know, on paper, probably the fastest sprinter. And I, you know, I saw that Edwig had kind of like tracked up the banking and he was looking like to go maybe early, so I accelerated as he tried to come over the top. And, you know, so I saw his move coming, which was fortunate. And then, I took his wheel as he came to the final bend. But the thing was, I don't think he really had much go. I wish he had a little bit more, you know, because then I for sure would have, I think I would have won the race. But he stalled, so I had to kind of restart, but I was fortunate to drop down underneath and take the short line. The rest is history. You know, Eddie won the sprint by, I guess it was a centimeter, something like that.
It was so close that it didn't seem like anybody was ready to raise his hands after the line.
I don't think so. No.
No. And then, so when you did cross the line, what were you thinking?
Well, you know, immediately I was thinking that I mistimed. I think we, you know, Eddie and I, we both mistimed the bike throw, which is obvious, you know, if you look at the photos and the videos, because the track is so big that the line is kind of more central to the straightaway, or it seems that way. I was just, you know, thinking that you're sprinting with all your power and all your energy, and it's almost like a blackout. You don't really see things coming that well. So we both sort of threw our bike after the line, you know, just because the line came up so fast. So yeah, you could say mistimed bike throw, yeah, for sure. But that's kind of just the way it was. And maybe Eddie was just sort of had his elbows bent a little bit more. I don't know. But that was the difference.
What was it like waiting around for that for the decision by the race judges? Where do you remember where you were? Were you in the infield? How were you feeling?
Yeah, I think it was in the infield. You know, I wasn't very confident that I got it. You know, probably just because of that feeling, you know, that I didn't get the bike throw in, you know, and part of that's just, I think because you're putting so much effort into getting to the line, and the straightaway was sort of seemed so short, you know. Yeah, it's bizarre, you know, having like that track experience maybe been against me in a way, because, you know, you have a feeling of where the line is on a velodrome. It just it seems to be further down the straight than in the center of the banking. Anyway, it was strange. I didn't get the bike throw in, and that's why I lost the race, really.
Do you think it was the right call?
Well, Noel Dianker, he was the director at the time. He said he saw the sprint photo. I've seen it. I've seen it also, but not at that time. I think it's legit. You know, it better be. But anyway, that's the way it is.
Plankert has said that winning by such a close margin made the victory more beautiful than by winning alone minutes ahead of the riders behind. For you, does coming second by millimeters conversely make it more of a heartbreak?
No, not necessarily. I don't. It is what it is. You know, I race for the best race. You know, it's one of those things. Same with my world championship in 1989 in Chambéry. I had a flat tire at the top of the climb, final lap. Would go to the sprint for the title with LeMond and Kelly and others. But yeah, it is what it is. This is the best race I ever rode in my career. Paris-Roubaix, same thing. What can you do? You have to be pragmatic about it, you know? It's one of those things.
I would say you're almost more than pragmatic. You're a bit zen. You're just a bit, this is how it went.
Yeah, no, it's sport. It's a one-day thing. Paris-Roubaix, what, 6 hours and 35 minutes? I don't remember the exact time, but that's all it is in your life. It's a bit, it's a big picture. It's a great memory, too. You know, you gotta think of it this way. It's quite an experience to be second in Paris-Roubaix by a centimeter.
It's true. It's people don't usually remember second place, but they do in this case.
It's the most memorable second place of the history of the sport.
There you go. Steve Bauer, thank you very much. And that's the episode. It's put together by me, Matthew Piero. It's produced by Adam Killick. He composed the music, too. I had help from web editors Terry McCall and Lily Hansen-Gillis. Thanks to Ontario Creates for its support. Please rate our show 5 stars, like a really good sector of pavé. This Sunday, as you face the absence of spring classics in 2020, do rewatch A Sunday in Hell, Jorgen Leith's documentary on the 1976 Paris-Roubaix. And then, I recommend you pick up William Fotheringham's book about the making of the documentary called Sunday in Hell. Wouldn't that just be hellacious? Which I mean in the good way, like not bad. I mean, enjoy both hells, and I'll talk to you later.